off the babysitter. Put on your pants. Come out with your hands up.
The following program is intended for mature audiences.
They used to bounce messages across the earth. Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show. Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows? Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
Truth, the half-truth, and nothing of the truth. Veritas News, now with Sal Manella.
Good evening, this is Sal Manella with the Veritas News. While the number of statues of Confederate Jefferson Davis continues to topple and fall, the number of American elementary schools bearing his name has held steady until now, that is, in a bold and brave decision, bucking the ire of the commander-in-tweet himself, the Jackson, Mississippi School District has changed the name of Jefferson Davis Elementary School to Barack Obama Elementary School. Despite the fact that 98% of the student body at the school is black, President Derelict Trump is asking Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, to deem the change unconstitutional because he said so. DeVos, already the target of Black America's rage for misspelling noted Black American W.E.B. Du Bois. DeVos, already a target of Black Americans' rage for misspelling the noted Black American W.E.B. Du Bois' name in a tweet, is said to be reluctant to engage in the controversy. Ironically, in an effort to make amends with America's blacks, DeVos is said to be busy installing an informational exhibit about W.E.B. in Detroit, titled Du Bois in the Hood. The opening of the exhibit is said to be delayed pending the access to clean drinking water at the museum. Mucklemouth, White House Press Secretary Huckabee Sanders, said that President Derelict Trump may issue yet another executive order forcing the name change back to Jefferson Davis Elementary, an act surely to please Trump's white supremacist-based of tiki torch Nazis. When asked about the preponderance and record number of Trump's executive orders, she said, quote, "Remember, most of Trump's executive orders are mostly his daily order for buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken and two scoops of ice cream," end quote. Former Keebler Elf and Attorney General Jeff Sessions said the renaming of the Mississippi school was an insult to his Southern heritage and that, furthermore, he may have, or probably may, maybe, possibly, could have, once studied Russia with Sergei Kislyak, maybe once or twice, who's to say, probably more when he lived in Russia and Moscow for a short time. Stunned reporters immediately asked, "You lived in Moscow?" To which Sessions said, quote, "I don't recall." DeVos at least came to Trump's aid by ordering the change in spelling for the state of Mississippi itself, proclaiming the removal of the last series of double consonants in the name to simply PPI. Apparently, Trump felt the inclusion of IPPI too suggestive of accounts revealing his salacious behavior with urinating prostitutes in a Moscow hotel. It's no mystery that President Derelict Donald Trump wants the United States space program to travel to Mars. The Donald's planned NASA budget, ironically, is an astronomically inadequate budget of just $1 million, a sum not even close to reaching Mars. Recent leaked emails, however, reveal that the president misunderstood, thinking that Mars was not the planet, but the singer Bruno Mars. Similar emails disclose also Trump's real feelings about Wisconsin's infamous sheriff, Clark, who Trump called a black hole. NASA officials had no comment regarding the president's misunderstandings, but one official was heard to say, "The densest matter in this universe is not neutron stars, but Donald Trump's brain." Finally, leaked documents from Donald Trump's preparatory high school reveal the drama department's refusal to produce his original play, citing financial difficulties and lack of stage space, including 140 characters. This has been Sal Manila with the Veritas News. Now here's Tom Savino with Savino Veritas.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
Okay, so a blind man walks into a bar, and then into the table and into a chair. This is Tom Savino with Savino Veritas, thanking you for joining us, and I hope you stay with us for this hour here at 148.ca/1SRN1 from Canada and 24/7 at juicetalk.com, www.juicetalk.com. In local news here in Burbank, the stationery store moved. Let's get to the fine wine of select gripes and the gripes of Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, W-H-I-N-E. We have a lot to whine about with select gripes from the gripe vine. A concealed truth, that's all a lie is. Either by omission or commission, we never do more than obscure. The truth stays in the undergrowth, waiting to be discovered. Josephine Hart from the book Damage.
Savino Veritas.
Total fabrication.
The gripes of wrath.
Compromise on the abolition of slavery. Can you expand on exactly what you're talking
about? Look, all of our leaders have flaws. Washington, Jefferson, Roosevelt, JFK, Kennedy.
Brilliant!
JFK, Kennedy.
Aren't you embarrassed?
That doesn't diminish their contributions to our country.
You would need three promotions to get to be an asshole.
Is there no one else? Is there no one else?
This is the artist D from forculture.com. In Wine the Truth? I believe so. You're listening to Tom Savino on SRN1 live. But be sure to hop over to juicedtalk.com to download after this broadcast. That's juicedtalk.com. Now, Tom, pour me another glass of wine and get back on my radio.
Week or two, that there was a Russian spy who was getting close to Hillary Clinton. This was reported in the mainstreams. You have Bill Clinton,
We're not going to get too real, but I want to ask you a couple fact-based questions.
Sure.
Who got the money when the Canadian company was sold to the Russian company, uranium one? Who received the money?
I presume the company, but look.
Yeah. Bing, bing, bing.
Okay, second question. Mm-hmm. Who approved the sale? Because when any sort of uranium or any company that sells sort of sensitive type products, and by the way, the uranium that's mined in these mines, right,
yep,
is for nuclear power. It's not for nuclear bombs, right? But when that happens, there is an organization called CFIUS that approves it. Do you know what CFIUS stands for?
Yes, absolutely.
What does it stand for?
Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States.
How many people sit on that committee?
9 members.
How many have to approve a deal like this?
All 9 of them,
members.
I believe.
How many approve this deal?
9 of them.
Boom.
Did Hillary Clinton sit personally on that deal?
No, but she
did
pushed
not.
For it.
She did not.
Hold on.
Who is the person who donated to Hillary Clinton who is related to and had an investment in Uranium One? What is that person's name? Do you remember their name?
They are board members of Uranium One, donated up to $143 million.
Tom Huestra. And when did Tom Huestra, did he own any assets in Uranium One at the time that Hillary Clinton was Secretary of State?
You know, I don't know that, but here's what.
Bing, bing, bing.
What I would,
sold them
here's what
years
I'd like
before.
To know.
So
here's
hold on one
you
second.
Should, you
no,
just want to know,
sold
too.
Sold them years before.
Yep.
So what you're talking about is a deal that nine members of CFIUS approved unanimously, none of whom was Hillary Clinton.
Bing, bing, bing.
You have a donor who separately gave Hillary Clinton donations at a time when she was not Secretary of State.
Bing, bing, bing.
The two things cross in the night. They have no relation to each other.
Bing, bing, bing.
The members of CFIUS have been very clear that Hillary Clinton had nothing to do with approving that deal.
Bing, bing, bing.
She would have had to strong arm eight other people in order to get them to unanimously approve the deal, and ultimately the President of the United States would intervene if they saw any problem. The CFIUS people say now, if that deal came before them today, they would still approve it unanimously.
Bing, bing, bing.
There's actually nothing about the deal that's controversial. The only reason we're talking about it is because, per your even admission, which I think is very honest, the RNC would like us to be talking about this now.
Bing, 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 bing.
Our democracy is directly under attack. Mr. Trump is dangerous. He has more than met the standard for impeachment.
I talked to a few people today in Washington, and then one of them said, how can he make a difference? And I thought to myself, knowing what we're about to launch here in the next few days about impeaching the President of the United States, I thought, you have no idea.
He's brought us to the brink of nuclear war, obstructed justice at the FBI, and in direct violation of the Constitution, he's taken money from foreign governments and threatened to shut down news organizations that report the truth. If that isn't a case for impeaching and removing a dangerous president, then what has our government become?
Hundreds of thousands of people in every state in America are signing a petition to impeach Donald Trump.
A national TV ad campaign calling for President Trump's impeachment.
The good thing about TV is that you reach millions of people. The good thing about a rally is that you're reaching a few people very powerfully.
Game day.
We all know the truth. This president is a clear and present danger to the health and safety of every American. We all know it, and the elected officials in Washington, D.C. know it as well. So what can we do about it? Here's what we can do. If you're with us, pull out your phone, go to www.needtoimpeach.com. Join us. In 3 days, we had hundreds of thousands of Americans sign on. So if you'll do this, we can raise our voice together. This is about the voice of the American people insisting to Washington, D.C. to end the silence. This man has to go. Thank you very much.
Alive. What are you proving? Just keep
See that you stand where Hitler stood. Now you are finding out that you should have worn your hood. Take off your swastikas, your armbands too. You're looking like a fool. Put out your tiki torch and go back to high school.
And many white people who mean right and in heart want to do right, but there are so few. If 10,000 rattlesnakes was coming down that aisle now, and I had a door here I could shut, and in that 10,000, 1,000 meant right. 1,000 rattlesnakes didn't want to bite me. I knew they were good. Should I let all these rattlesnakes come down, hoping that 1,000 get together and form a shield? Or should I just close the door and stay safe?
I think that
you understand. The Viet Cong are not all bad, but America's still dropping bombs. In Hiroshima, the Japan wasn't bad, but she still dropped the bomb. In Korea, they weren't bad, but they still dropped the bomb. So now I'm going to forget the 400 years of lynching and killing and raping and depriving my people of freedom, justice, equality, first fired, last hired, the lowest of low, last respected. And I'm going to look at two or three white people who are trying to do right and don't see the other million trying to kill me. I'm not that big of a fool, and I'm not going to deny it.
Father, let me love you. Saw you wandering in my dream last night, singing, wonder, wonder what you might do. You can't simply hide a dream in the blue. Don't try to find.
Mr. President.
Senator from Arizona.
Mr. President, I rise today to address a matter that has been very much on my mind. At a moment when it seems that our democracy is more defined by our discord and our dysfunction than by our own values and principles, let me begin by noting a somewhat obvious point that these offices that we hold are not ours indefinitely. We're not here simply to mark time. Sustained incumbency is certainly not the point of seeking office, and there are times when we must risk our careers in favor of our principles. Now is such a time. It must also be said that I rise today with no small measure of regret. Regret because of the state of our disunion. Regret because of the disrepair and destructiveness of our politics. Regret because of the indecency of our discourse. Regret because of the coarseness of our leadership. Regret for the compromise of our moral authority. And by our, I mean all of our, complicity in this alarming and dangerous state of affairs. It is time for our complicity and our accommodation of the unacceptable to end. In this century, a new phrase has entered the language to describe the accommodation of a new and undesirable order, that phrase being the new normal. But we must never adjust to the present coarseness of our national dialogue with the tone set at the top. We must never regard as normal the regular and casual undermining of our democratic norms and ideals. We must never meekly accept the daily sundering of our country. The personal attacks, the threats against principles, freedoms, and institution, the flagrant disregard for truth and decency, the reckless provocations, most often for the pettiest and most personal reasons, reasons having nothing whatsoever to do with the fortunes of the people that we have been elected to serve. None of these appalling features of our current politics should ever be regarded as normal. We must never allow ourselves to lapse into thinking that that is just the way things are now. If we simply become inured to this condition, thinking that it is just politics as usual, then heaven help us. Without fear of the consequences, and without consideration of rules of what is politically safe or palatable, we must stop pretending that the degradation of our politics and the conduct of some in our executive branch are normal. They are not normal. Reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior has become excused and countenanced as telling it like it is, when it is actually just reckless, outrageous, and undignified. And when such behavior emanates from the top of our government, it is something else. It is dangerous to a democracy. Such behavior does not project strength, because our strength comes from our values. It instead projects a corruption of the spirit and weakness. It is often said that children are watching. Well, they are. And what are we going to do about that? When the next generation asks us, why didn't you do something? Why didn't you speak up? What are we going to say? Mr. President, I rise today to say, enough. We must dedicate ourselves to making sure that the anomalous never becomes the normal. With respect and humility, I must say that we have fooled ourselves for long enough that a pivot to governing is right around the corner, a return to civility and stability right behind it. We know better than that. By now, we all know better than that. Here today, I stand to say that we would better serve the country by better fulfilling our obligations under the Constitution by adhering to our Article I, Old Normal, Mr. Madison's doctrine of separation of powers. This genius innovation, which affirms Madison's status as a true visionary, for which Madison argued in Federalist 51, held that the equal branches of our government would balance and counteract with each other, if necessary. Ambition counteracts ambition, he wrote. But what happens if ambition fails to counteract ambition? What happens if stability fails to assert itself in the face of chaos and instability? If decency fails to call out indecency? Were the shoe on the other foot, would we Republicans meekly accept such behavior on display from dominant Democrats? Of course we wouldn't, and we would be wrong if we did. When we remain silent and fail to act, when we know that silence and inaction is the wrong thing to do because of political considerations, because we might make enemies, because we might alienate the base, because we might provoke a primary challenge, because ad infinitum, ad nauseum, when we succumb to those considerations in spite of what should be greater considerations and imperatives in defense of our institutions and our liberty, we dishonor our principles and forsake our obligations. Those things are far more important than politics. Now, I'm aware that more politically savvy people than I will caution against such talk. I am aware that there is a segment of my party that believes that anything short of complete and unquestioning loyalty to a president who belongs to my party is unacceptable and suspect. If I have been critical, it is not because I relish criticizing the behavior of the President of the United States. If I have been critical, it is because I believe it is my obligation to do so, and as a matter and duty of conscience. The notion that one should stay silent as the norms and values that keep America strong are undermined, and as the alliances and agreements that ensure the stability of the entire world are routinely threatened by the level of thought that goes into 140 characters. The notion that we should say or do nothing in the face of such mercurial behavior is ahistoric, and I believe profoundly misguided. A Republican president named Roosevelt had this to say about the president and a citizen's relationship to the office. Quote, "The president is merely the most important among a large number of public servants. He should be supported or opposed exactly to the degree which is warranted by his good conduct or bad conduct, his efficiency or inefficiency in rendering loyal, able, and disinterested service to the nation as a whole." He continued, "Therefore, it is absolutely necessary that there should be a full liberty to tell the truth about his acts, and this means that it is exactly as necessary to blame him when he does wrong as to praise him when he does right. Any other attitude in an American citizen is both base and servile. President Roosevelt continued to announce that there must be no criticism of the president, or that we are to stand by a president, right or wrong, is not only unpatriotic and servile, but is morally treasonable to the American public, unquote. Acting on conscience and principle in a manner is the manner in which we express our moral selves, and as such, loyalty to conscience and principle should supersede loyalty to any man or party. We can all be forgiven for failing in that measure from time to time. I certainly put myself at the top of the list of those who fall short in this regard. I am holier than none. But too often we rush not to salvage principle, but to forgive and excuse our failures so that we might accommodate them and go right on failing until the accommodation itself becomes our principle. In that way, and over time, we can justify almost any behavior and sacrifice any principle. I'm afraid that this is where we now find ourselves. When a leader correctly identifies real hurt and insecurity in our country and instead of addressing it goes to look for someone to blame, there is perhaps nothing more devastating to a pluralistic society. Leadership knows that most often a good place to start in assigning blame is to look somewhat closer to home. Leadership knows where the buck stops. Humility helps. Character counts. Leadership does not knowingly encourage or feed ugly or debased appetites in us. Leadership lives by the American creed, E pluribus unum, from many one. American leadership looks to the world and, just as Lincoln did, sees the family of man. Humanity is not a zero-sum game. When we have been at our most prosperous, we have been at our most principled. And when we do well, the rest of the world does well. These articles of civic faith have been critical to the American identity for as long as we have been alive. They are our birthright and our obligation. We must guard them jealously and pass them on for as long as the calendar has days. To betray them or to be unserious in their defense is a betrayal of the fundamental obligations of American leadership, and to behave as if they don't matter is simply not who we are. Now, the efficacy of American leadership around the globe has come into question. When the United States emerged from World War II, we contributed about half of the world's economic activity. It would have been easy to secure our dominance, keeping those countries who had been defeated or greatly weakened during the war in their place. We didn't do that. It would have been easy to focus inward. We resisted those impulses. Instead, we financed reconstruction of shattered countries and created international organizations and institutions that have helped provide security and foster prosperity around the world for more than 70 years. Now it seems that we, the architects of this visionary, rules-based world order that has brought so much freedom and prosperity, are the ones most eager to abandon it. The implications of this abandonment are profound, and the beneficiaries of this rather radical departure in the American approach to the world are the ideological enemies of our values. Despotism loves a vacuum, and our allies are now looking elsewhere for leadership. Why are they doing this? None of this is normal. And what do we, as United States senators, have to say about it? The principles that underlie our politics, the values of our founding, are too vital to our identity and to our survival to allow them to be compromised by the requirements of politics. Because politics can make us silent when we should speak, and silence can equal complicity. I have children and grandchildren to answer to, and so, Mr. President, I will not be complicit or silent. I've decided that I would be better able to represent the people of Arizona and to better serve my country and my conscience by freeing myself of the political consideration that consume far too much bandwidth and would cause me to compromise far too many principles. To that end, I am announcing today that my service in the Senate will conclude at the end of my term in early January 2019. It is clear at this moment that a traditional conservative who believes in limited government and free markets, who is devoted to free trade, who is pro-immigration, has a narrower and narrower path to nomination in the Republican Party, the party that has so long defined itself by its belief in those things. It is also clear to me for the moment that we have given in or given up on the core principles in favor of a more viscerally satisfying anger and resentment. To be clear, the anger and resentment that the people feel at the royal mess that we've created are justified. But anger and resentment are not a governing philosophy. There is an undeniable potency to a populist appeal by mischaracterizing or misunderstanding our problems and giving in to the impulse to scapegoat and belittle. The impulse to scapegoat and belittle threatens to turn us into a fearful, backward-looking people. In the case of the Republican Party, those things also threaten to turn us into a fearful, backward-looking minority party. We were not made great as a country by indulging in or even exalting our worst impulses, turning against ourselves, glorifying in the things that divide us, and calling fake things true and true things fake. And we did not become the beacon of freedom in the darkest corners of the world by flouting our institutions and failing to understand just how hard-won and vulnerable they are. This spell will eventually break. That is my belief. We will return to ourselves once more, and I say the sooner the better. Because we have a healthy government, we must also have healthy and functioning parties. We must respect each other again in an atmosphere of shared facts and shared values, comity, and good faith. We must argue our positions fervently and never be afraid to compromise. We must assume the best of our fellow man and always look for the good. Until that day comes, we must be unafraid to stand up and speak out as if our country depends on it, because it does. I plan to spend the remaining 14 months of my Senate term doing just that. Mr. President, the graveyard is full of indispensable men and women. None of us here is indispensable. Nor were even the great figures of history who toiled at these very desks in this very chamber to shape the country that we have inherited. What is indispensable are the values that they consecrated in Philadelphia and in this place, values which have endured and will endure for so long as men and women wish to remain free. What is indispensable is what we do here in defense of those values. A political career does not mean much if we are complicit in undermining these values. I thank my colleagues for indulging me here today. I will close by borrowing the words of President Lincoln, who knew more about healthy enmity and preserving our founding values than any other American who has ever lived. His words from his first inaugural were a prayer in his time and are now no less in ours. We are not enemies, but friends. We must not be enemies. Though passion may have strained, it must not break the bonds of our affection. The mystic chords of memory will swell when again touched, as surely as they will be, by the better angels of our nature. Thank you, Mr. President. I yield the floor.
Senator Jeff Flake's patriotic speech really prompted me to write to the LA Times and the Burbank Leader newspapers here in Southern California, my local papers, and they were kind enough on October the 26th to print my letter, and here it is. Dear Burbank readers, sometime between last election day and inauguration day, I warned the citizens of Burbank to insist, as I was then insisting, in demanding candidates of the city council reveal party affiliations. I went on to advise my fellow citizens to then avoid, of course, voting for any one of them arrogantly proud enough to label him or herself Republican. Because doing so, I reasoned, was tantamount to espousing allegiance to Nazi-like fascism and authoritarian rule. Of course, as it turned out, I was preaching to the choir. Today, however, highly respected conservative Republican U.S. Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona not only joined the ranks of the few real GOP Americans like McCain and Corker, but to my mind earned membership into the pantheon of patriots equal to Americans like Patrick Henry. The complicit GOP will either remain silent and count their coins, or try to save their party and possibly the entire nation by telling the truth, taking a stand, and impeaching King Khan, sexual predator in chief and traitor, our illegitimate so-called president. Still a Republican and willing to say so? Get used to independents and Democrats stepping up to tear you down, because unless you wake up and come clean, it's either America or your fascist party. Thomas Savino, Burbank, California.
Is your company looking to maximize their output while cutting back on costs? Why outsource all your production to faraway countries like India, China, and Narnia when we have the cheapest and best workforce right here in the good old US of A? Women. That's right. With Pink Sourcing, women are a bargain at the workplace since you only have to pay them 77 cents on the dollar. Right, Kathy?
Wait, what? I make 60 cents. Who are you, Bill Gates?
Vicky, I make 55 cents. Who is she, Yeezy?
No, come on. Those are men. Even more importantly, you don't have to pay women overtime. They'll never ask for a raise, and they don't complain about their working conditions. Right, Kathy? Don't forget, women are great at remembering birthdays. They're the only ones who bring baked goods into the office, and they smell nice. Also, you don't have to pay for women's birth control. And if they do get knocked up, when they leave to have the baby, you get off scot-free. But don't worry, guys, your boner pills are still covered. And ladies, who cares if you make 30,000 less than men at your job when they have free tampons in the bathroom? Best of all, you can promote literally anyone else besides them, especially if they're less qualified.
You're late for the 3 o'clock cuddle.
Ooh, sorry, Kathy.
My name is Sharon. Bitch.
After all, women don't even really want to be working anyway. They'd rather be home, taking care of the family, while their husband gets to make life choices and follow his dreams and play fantasy football. So try Pink Sourcing today. Pink Sourcing, pretty cheap labor. Will also work for compliments.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
I've been thinking about what to call you and Blowhard. Blowhard's too kind, idiot. Well, idiot's too vague.
Rachel Maddow's advice to America is stop listening to what Trump says. Stop reading what he tweets. And pay attention to what is being done while the diversion is put in our face and we're distracted. On that issue, the other day, the Senate voted 51-50 to give immunity to banks who rip us off, when they rip us off. And certainly there's an extended history of banks ripping us off in many ways over the history of banks and the history of America. And they will do it again. And they will certainly do it again now that our government, the people that we have elected, are mostly, I'm sorry to say, folks, but those of you who are Republicans, I'm sorry, you have elected some pretty, pretty corrupt people. And they have allowed our government to give immunity to banks for ripping us off. There would be no recourse if they rip us off. It's like, oh, sorry we did that. But nothing, no recourse, because they have immunity. They can't be sued.
I'm gonna make a now
by you, me, or even a collective group in a class action suit. And also, while we're paying attention to controversial tweets and other ridiculous controversies, what's happening now is that the San Juan mayor, that's the biggest town in Puerto Rico, San Juan mayor calls to void contract awarded to tiny Montana company. The mayor of Puerto Rico's largest city is calling for a contract to fix the island's hurricane-ravaged electrical grid to be, quote, voided, end quote, after it was awarded to a small Montana firm. Whitefish Energy last week signed a $300 million contract to help overhaul the island's grid following Hurricane Maria. The company is only 2 years old and had just two employees to make $300 million. Just two employees when the territory's utility, Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, PREPA, signed the contract. It is based in the Montana hometown of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke. Coincidence? Not so, obviously. San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz told Yahoo News in an interview published Wednesday that the contract is, quote, alarming. She said, quote, the contract should be voided right away in a proper process which is clear, transparent, legal, moral, and ethical should take place, end quote. And she continued, quote, it seems like what the Puerto Rican people are going to be paying for, or the American people are going to be paying for, is an intermediary that doesn't know what is at stake here, and that really has to subcontract everything. What we need is somebody that can get the job done, and that has the experience, the expertise to get the job done, end quote. Whitefish and the Puerto Rican government have defended the contract. The company said in a statement Wednesday that Cruz's comments are, quote, misplaced, end quote, noting a workforce of 300 people on the island. Well, that may be so, but they're all subcontracted through this Whitefish company. Quote, we are making progress and doing work when others are not even here, end quote, the company said. Quote, we find her comments to be very disappointing and demoralizing to the hundreds of people on our team that have left their homes and families to come here to help the people of Puerto Rico, end quote. In a statement, Puerto Rican Governor Ricardo Rosello said the contract went to Whitefish because it didn't need money up front, something the island's struggling utility couldn't provide. Quote, Of all those who met the requirements and aggressive schedules to bring brigades, one was asking for a substantial amount of money, which PREPA, P-R-E-P-A, had no liquidity for, and another did not require it, he said. Quote, that other one is Whitefish, end quote. So you see how the game plays, ladies and gentlemen. If you are a friend of Trump's, if you are the Secretary of Interior, Ryan Zinke, you get your people to do the job, and you give them a little bone, no money up front, which understandably was a problem for Puerto Rico. But that's how it gets done, and companies that have to subcontract get the deals because they're the Trump cronies.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
So what's so fishy about Whitefish, the Whitefish contract in Puerto Rico? As President Trump says, Puerto Rico? Puerto Rico. If we ever needed any evidence of the corruption of the Trump fascist regime, it is documented in this contract. The Whitefish Corporation was contracted because Interior Secretary and friend of Donald Trump, Zinke from Montana, without bidding, no bids to this contract, hired Whitefish Company in Montana, in the hometown of Zinke. This company had two employees and were given $300 million to rebuild the electric grid in Puerto Rico. Now, here's what people are complaining about, rightfully so, and why the mayor of San Juan deemed the contract null and void because of unethical, immoral elements of the contract like this. It says, Article 59 of the contract, Section 1, in no event shall the Puerto Rican Electrical Power Authority, the Commonwealth of Puerto Rico itself, the FEMA administrator, the Controller General of the United States, or any of their authorized representatives have the right to audit or review the cost and profit elements of the labor rates specified herein. Ultimately, this contract is saying, Puerto Rico, we've contracted to steal from you. You have no right to ask how or how much or when or by whom. Shut up and enjoy it.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Remember, folks, forget about the tweets. Forget about the controversies drummed up by the Trump campaign to divert. Watch what they do. This is what they do.
Also, as we've mentioned before, chief White House ethics lawyer under a Republican president, Bush 43, as well as Howard Dean, a former Vermont governor and former chairman of the DNC. Richard, I go, of course, to you first. What happened in court today factually? And then, as an advocate, which I know you are, what arguments do you think could win the day for your side?
Well, the arguments today were on a motion to dismiss brought by the Justice Department on behalf of the President of the United States. They want the case dismissed on two grounds. One, they claim that CRU, the organization of which I am vice chair and also counsel, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, does not have standing to bring the lawsuit. And the second argument is that we are wrong in our interpretation of the Emoluments Clause, that this clause of the Constitution only applies to the narrowest possible circumstances where the clause would basically be meaningless. We contest that in on both issues. We believe we do have standing to bring this lawsuit, that we as a government reform group have been injured by the conduct of the president, and that furthermore, the conduct of the president is in violation of the Constitution. And this is about a lot more than just who stays in the hotels and books the hotel rooms. It's about the financing of the Trump business empire. Any real estate empire is dependent upon an enormous amount of borrowed money and other equity investors. We don't know who they are. All we know about Donald mm-hmm. Trump is that ever since the mid-1990s, the New York banks wouldn't loan any money to him because they didn't like not getting paid back. We don't know where he's getting his money from, and if it's from foreign governments, it's in violation of the Constitution. We know there's money from the Bank of China. We found that out. But we want to know about what other money from foreign governments are coming into this president. Is he dependent on foreign governments and banks and sovereign wealth funds controlled by foreign governments in violation of the Constitution? We need to find that out now.
Right. And your case, I think, is an important way for, as you put it, for people to find out. There are really two things here, Richard. I'll wait for you from some sound from a Trump lawyer for your response, because there's number one, the almost national security argument you make, that all of us should care a lot whether there are secret foreign deals being made that have reward or leverage over our government. And yet that, in one sense, is a policy discussion. The constitutional argument, as you well know, is that you have to convince this court that emoluments are in play here, that this is a gift. I want to take a play here that you can listen to of Sherry Dillon, the president's lawyer, saying, whatever you think about all this, it's not a gift under the Constitution.
Paying for a hotel room is not a gift or a present, and it has nothing to do with an office. It's not an emolument. The Constitution does not require President-elect Trump to do anything here. President-elect Trump has decided, and we are announcing today, that he is going to voluntarily donate all profits from foreign government payments made to his hotels to the United States Treasury.
What do you say, Richard, to the argument there that this is a fair market value transaction, not a gift?
Well, she's just flat out wrong in her interpretation of the Constitution. The founders are well aware of this problem. The foreign governments, including, by the way, Russia at the time, they were doing it way back then, trying to corrupt other countries' governments through payoffs to their politicians. And that includes presents, any value-added transaction, and furthermore, any emolument. And an emolument is a profit or benefit and from a dealing with a foreign country or an entity controlled by a foreign country's government. And it's very clear in the Constitution what the founders intended to prohibit. They were not stupid. They knew that countries like Russia, Great Britain, France, Austria-Hungary at the time, now, of course, we have China and many other countries who would try to corrupt our government. And once again, it's about a lot more than just hotel rooms. This is about the financing structure of the Trump business empire. We have no idea where he's borrowing his money. We have no idea who the other equity investors are. We don't know where the money's coming from. Does he have a dependency relationship with Russia, with China, with any other foreign government? And we want the judge in this case to find out the facts and then decide whether the president is in compliance with the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution.
Governor Dean, this case, how important do you think it is in the Trump era?
Extremely important. First of all, the attorney who was defending Trump was factually incorrect. Many of the hotel payments that have gone to the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C. have been well above market. In fact, their volume is not that great, but they make up the money by charging certain delegations enormous amounts that aren't disclosed. That's the first thing. The second thing is that Trump has promised to donate large sums of money to all kinds of people. It came out today that he once promised to donate $25,000 to the family of somebody who lost their child defending the United States. And you know, he doesn't pay. He always promises. This is his pattern, his business pattern for many, many years, long before he was in the White House. So the fact that he's going to donate his foreign profits means absolutely nothing, because he's promised all sorts of things like that before. Thirdly, this is, and I defer to Richard because I'm not an attorney, this clause I don't believe has ever actually been tried, but it was designed to defend exactly against this. And I actually think Bob Mueller is going to have a lot to say about this, because part of his investigation is to find out, for example, did Trump, who sold his white elephant house in Florida to a Russian for an exorbitant amount of money, was that participation in laundering? If that's the case, you know, that's clearly an emolument. He got some money, the Russian got some money, it was illegal. I think Mueller's going to find out all that stuff. So this case is not going to go away based on what this particular judge decides. It's going to come back again and again and again.
I'll ask you the plain English common sense question. When this government, the Trump administration, says it's not logical to think that people would try to curry favor by throwing money at his businesses, does that pass the laugh test for you as someone who ran a state government? And obviously you had lobbyists and other people trying to get to you.
Well, I mean, the scale of Trump's malfeasance is extraordinary. And the answer is this has been going on for a very long time. Jared is going to be investigated, probably is being investigated now, because he got into a lot of trouble when his family bought 666 Fifth Avenue. The value of the building went way down. He had to get bailing out. Nobody, as Richard pointed out, is going to lend the Trumps money because they don't pay it back. And so there's a lot of question about where the money for that came. And most people believe it came from a Russian oligarch. So this is a pattern that's going on. And I think this case is really important because it's the straight up emoluments case, which has never been argued before in 200 and some odd years of history. But if you don't think Bob Mueller's looking into this kind of stuff, I think we all would have to have a second look.
Bottom of my heart, everyone, thank you for listening to Savina Veritas tonight and every Thursday night on 148.ca/1 and 24/7 on the Too Cool for School website, juicedtalk.com. All shows of Savina Veritas can be heard at juicedtalk.com. Remember, friends, I may be joking, but I'm never kidding.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
Now, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.